Hello and welcome to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm Ralph Russo, college football writer with the Associated Press. It's another two-guest episode here on the show. First up, we love talking to coaches in new jobs, so this week we'll catch up with Bill O'Brien, who has had a fascinating offseason, briefly taking the Ohio State offensive coordinator job before becoming the new head coach at Boston College in February. Then Stephen Godfrey from the Split Zone Duo podcast joins the show to cheer me up. Stephen is excited about the new college football playoff, and I could use some cheering up after a few months of rather discouraging news on that front. Stephen and I dig through all the possibilities and what's to like about the upcoming expanded playoff. Plus, I pose the question to Stephen, who could be the next G5 school to blossom into a future power conference program? Maybe the more relevant question is, will that even be possible anymore? And he spun it back to me, will we even think of all of this the same way as FBS goes from a two-tier system to more of a three-tier system? Thanks for listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you like to get your pods. If you like what you hear, please give us a good rating and review. It helps college football fans find us. It helps us find more college football fans. And away we go. Joining me this week on the podcast is the new coach of Boston College, Bill O'Brien. Bill, you don't have to worry, but you look fine, but we don't use the video, so don't worry about that.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about sitting up straight there. Hey, man, listen, I very much appreciate you coming on the show. You have had a pretty interesting last 4 months. Yeah. Going from the Patriots to Ohio State to BC. Let me just start there. And the first question I'm going to ask is more of a big picture question. But I mean, do you have your wits about you? Have you been able to settle in? You've had three jobs in the last 6 months, Bill.
Yeah. No. It was. Yeah. It's been an interesting. Let's just call it 18 months, no doubt about it. I mean, you know, when I had the opportunity to come back to the Patriots, you know, it was at that time, it was a really good opportunity for my family. When I went to Alabama, my family had stayed in Houston so that my youngest son could graduate from high school down in Houston. And so, you know, I was at Alabama, my family didn't move there. So it was important after those 2 years at Alabama, which were great. I loved Alabama. But when we went back to New England, it was important because we were able to get all back together. And so that was a big part of the decision. And then, you know, obviously the season didn't go great in New England, and, you know, I had the opportunity to stay and work for, you know, Gerard Mayo. And I just decided that, you know, look, he has to hire his own people. I thought that it was important for him to be able to do that. Having been a head coach, you gotta put your own staff around you. And so, had a great opportunity with Ryan Day at Ohio State, and went to Ohio State, had a good 3 weeks there. This job opened up, and Boston College contacted me, and, you know, I just feel like it's a great fit. You know, my wife went to school here. I'm from here. I believe in Boston College. I grew up a Boston College fan, and I love my job. I love coming to work every day, you know, coaching these kids. It's been, you know, I've been here for about 2 months. We've got a really good staff. It's been good. I'm very settled, you know, if that makes sense. So I feel good being here.
Well, right, because it's home, right? Yeah. I'm sure you have a little more support system, family, at least a little closer than maybe Houston or Alabama would have been, I'm sure.
That's right.
So here's the big picture question I want to ask you. And I want to make sure I preface this. This is not a knock on any coach deciding to do anything. But there's been a lot of conversation around college football lately of, and listen, it's one of the reasons why the job opened up at BC to a certain degree. You have some coaches who have decided, like, man, college sports, it's a little chaotic right now. I don't know if this is really the perfect fit for me. So if those coaches have opportunities to maybe head to the NFL, like Jeff Hafley did, they take advantage of it. You were in the NFL. You probably could have stayed in the NFL. Bill, I don't want to root around your bank account, but my guess is you could probably have gone work for a do a little television and hung out on a boat somewhere too. So with all that said, like, why did you decide in these chaotic times when everybody seems to be quote unquote fleeing college football to decide, nah, college football, that's a good spot for me?
I just, there was something, by the way, everything that you said, I tend to agree with relative to the chaotic nature of college football right now. But when this job opened up, I felt like this was a really good fit for me and my wife and my two kids, because there's a connection here. Like, I believe in this place. I know that, you know, this is a place where you can do really good things and you can really impact a lot of young guys' lives. And so, you know, plus you can be involved in the campus community. You know, the people here that I've met so far, it's been awesome the 2 months that I've been here. And I look forward to coming to work every single day. I feel great about coming to work every single day. And you know, look, relative to our Boston College's niche in this college football landscape, you know, no, we're not going to be in the NIL world of some of the bigger schools, but we'll be in the world of NIL. We'll be in the world a little bit of the portal, but we're going to build the place through selling what we're about. You know, what we're about is, you know, coming here, getting developed to play great football, you know, get a great education and give back to the community. That's what BC's always been about. And so we're building it on that. We're being very strategic about who we recruit and who we target. And, you know, I believe in the place. I believe we can do it. And so I immediately, when I was contacted, I said, you know what, for me, 54 years old, I would love to finish, you know, my career at Boston College, having done some good things there. So hopefully it turns out that way.
I think traditionally, you know, I think of Boston College like a lot of Catholic schools, right? Your recruiting base is, there's a local recruiting base, but because you're a Catholic school, maybe you can reach outside the borders a little bit and go a little farther. And you know, Notre Dame is the classic example of this, but again, I think there's these Catholic schools all have this ability to maybe reach a little farther out. When you consider, though, just again, the changing landscape of college football, what's going on in the ACC, NIL and things along those lines, do you have to have can you fall back on the traditional recruiting strategies that won at BC, or do you have to have a different model of how you're recruiting and where you're recruiting to win at BC?
I think that what I did was, when I was preparing to it was a three-stage interview process for this job. So that, you know, it was probably the most thorough interview process that I ever went through for any job. You know, it started out as a phone call, an hour-long phone call, and then they whittled the list down, and then they flew you to Atlanta at the search firm, you know, six finalists, and then three finalists were flown to Boston. And within that time, I did a lot of research of Boston College in the history of the football program here. And so there's been some common themes, kind of like what you're saying. You know, there's always been a really good quarterback when they've won, you know, obviously Flutie, Matt Ryan. You know, there's been a lot of other, the Hasselbecks, some really good quarterbacks here when they've won. And then there've been a real core nucleus of mostly guys from the Northeast, some from Ohio, some from Pennsylvania, Catholic schools, Jesuit schools, not all of them, but, you know, some from Florida, some from Texas. You know, there's some really good Jesuit high schools in Texas. And so that's really the formula that wins here. Now, like you said, do you have to, you know, maybe go to some different parts relative to what this is about right now? Yeah, I just did a Zoom call with a quarterback from Wyoming. You know, so yeah, there's going to be some places that you're going to have to look to find some kids that maybe are under recruited and can really fit the bill for you here at BC. But I think in the end, that's a strong formula of what's been successful in the past. When I've talked to Coach Bicknell, Coach Coughlin, the Coach O'Brien, those are the three best coaches that ever coached here. Mm-hmm. And those guys all had similar formulas.
Yeah. Again, it always felt like, you also, the other thing I've always noticed at Boston College, when things go well, and the places they have a chance to do well in recruiting is along the offensive line.
Right.
It seems like they've had, even recently with, you know, Christian Mahogany going in.
Right.
They maybe have had some issues keeping some of those guys healthy under Hafley, but for the most part, with the good Boston College teams, have had good offensive lines. I'm just, you know, it's not like you've been out. Like, listen, you're only 1 year in the NFL, so you were just with the Bama and college football. But I guess when you look at NFL offense, which you've done for a long time, college offense, which you've done for a long time, you've accumulated all this knowledge and all these different type of quarterbacks you've worked with, but then you also have to implement a strategy that might work best for Boston College. What does that look like?
Yeah, we will run, you know, I think a combination of what we, so even since Penn State, when you and I really first met, like when I was at Penn State, it's evolved since then. And I actually, when I went to Alabama, I learned a ton at Alabama about college offense. You know, when you go to Alabama and you work for Nick Saban, you were running that offense. You weren't bringing your offense into that deal. So I actually had to learn that offense, learn how to teach it, and then learn how to call it. And fortunately, we had a great quarterback, Bryce Young, and it was, you know, a good couple of years there. But it'll be a combination of that and then the foundation of some of the things we did at Penn State, did in New England, did in Houston. That's really the foundation of it. But we adapted a lot of our philosophy to what we did at Alabama. And I brought – there's a couple guys here with me. Will Lawing is our offensive coordinator, who was with me at Alabama. So it'll be a combination of those. We've got a pretty good playbook. The kids, we're about halfway through spring practice, and the guys are picking it up pretty well. So, you know, it'll be a little bit of everything.
Wow, I didn't realize you were that far in. You're almost done.
Yeah, tomorrow morning, it'll be our ninth practice.
All right, so what have you seen so far?
Yeah, I like what I've seen. I mean, look, I think that, you know, when I came in here, I talked to Jeff Hafley, and he was awesome. He, you know, we spoke two or three times before I took the job, and, you know, he told me that this was going to be his best team coming back, and I can see why he said that. There's some really good players on both sides of the ball, and, you know, a good quarterback and Tommy Castellanos. So I've really enjoyed coaching these guys. It's a morning program, so these kids wake up at 5:30 in the morning. They get breakfast. They get taped. They're in meetings at 7 a.m. We practice from 9 to about 11, and then they go to class. So it's been a lot of fun to coach these guys, and I think they're working hard, and it's not always pretty, but we're getting better every day, which is good. That's the sign of a good team is, you know, you improve every day. So that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, Castellano was a hell of a player to watch last year.
Yeah,
he was just a freshman last year, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
He's got 2 years of eligibility left. So
okay, it's a little hard to keep up these days with the eligibility. But I mean, not to go too deep into your roster, because I'd be trying to lie my way through it. I think the product spoke for itself last year, right? I think that they were not expected necessarily to do big things, played better as the season went along, and as you said, I could see why Jeff Hafley would have said, "Look, I like the team I had coming back next year." But let's just talk about Castellano, because, again, he became a player who I think college football fans were drawn to because of his style of play. Yeah. You know, I'll just throw it out to you. Like, what do you think he can do with that kid?
No, I'm telling you, it is fun to watch him play. I mean, he's very instinctive. Obviously, he can, you know, he makes a lot of off schedule plays. He's a very athletic. He's not the biggest guy in the world, but he's very competitive and he's smart. And what we've tried to do is to teach him our style of passing game, you know, kind of like, if you remember, like what we did with Matt McGloin at Penn State, it's similar to what we're trying to do here with what we're doing now. And he's had a good spring. You know, he's learned a lot about what we're trying to do, our system, you know, how we attack defenses. And I couldn't be happier with where the guy is. You know, at this point in the spring, about, you know, a little bit more than halfway through the spring, he's really done a good job. And I he is exciting. I like watching the practice film when we come in after practice, because you're always looking forward to maybe some of the plays that he's made in practice. So he's fun to watch.
Yeah. Don't rein him in, man. I know you want to. I know you got to get him in structure too. You have to be able to play in structure, but I hope you don't rein him in too much.
Let him play. You're exactly right, Ralph. We have to let him play and be who he is, and we just try to give him some things to guide him along the way. And as long as he takes care of the ball and understands what we're trying to do in the game plan, I think he's going to have a really good year.
Okay, let me finish up with this. And it's just on the personal side. I know you have a son with special needs that your wife, spends. You both take care of, but certainly is something that happens that your wife is very much. I would say it's her full time job, right? It's fair enough to say.
Yes.
How is Jack doing? And I'm also wondering, like, is the Boston area a better area for you to be in and for him to be in, for your wife to be in to handle that part of your life?
Thank you for asking, Ralph. Yeah, he's doing okay. You know, it's a daily struggle. As you get older with his, you know, brain issues, it's tough, you know, breathing issues, seizure issues. And I can't, you know, it's hard to put into words what my wife has meant to our lives, to his life. You know, Colleen takes care of him 24/7, and it's amazing to watch. When they talk about unconditional love, that's what you're observing with my wife and Jack every single day. So he's definitely outlived expectations, Ralph. You know, when I was at Penn State, you remember me telling you, like, he wasn't supposed to live past 2, and he'll be 22 in August. So he's definitely outlived expectations, and he's a great kid. And you know, it's tough. It's tough some days, but he's a fighter. He battles every single day, and he's got a great younger brother who is close by, goes to Tufts. Michael goes to Tufts, plays baseball at Tufts. And so, you know, Michael gets home a lot because he cares about his brother and seeing his mom and stuff. So it's been good. It's been good.
Good. I'm glad to hear that again. I know that's been a challenge for your family, but I'm sure in many ways a blessing too. Right.
Yep, thank you.
Bill, man, it's really good catching up with you. Thank you so much for doing this today. Good luck with BC, man. Like I said, it's an interesting adventure. And, you know, again, I was just glad after all these coaches were leaving college football that there were still a few who actually wanted to take these jobs.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, it was awesome. So I appreciate it, Ralph, and good to catch up with you. And hopefully you're up in Boston. You come by practice someday.
That sounds good to me. All right. Bill O'Brien from Boston College. So this week on the podcast, here's the thing. I was feeling a little down recently about college football. And, you know, it's just the news about the playoff has been kind of bumming me out a little bit. And I thought to myself, I need somebody known for positivity. I need somebody with a sunny and optimistic outlook on things in this sport. So in listening to the Split Zone Duo podcast, I came across my buddy Stephen Godfrey, who, you know, suddenly, really, Stephen, like, you are just a beacon of hope these days when it comes to college football. So I had to bring you on to cheer me up.
It's a 9-month off season. So sometimes you have to do things that are wildly out of character just to sort of keep yourself interested. But yes, I did. What Ralph is referring to is that I recently wrote and hosted an episode of our podcast, Split Zone Duo. You can subscribe at splitzoneduo.com. And positivity was not the goal, nor was it the intended, like, wasn't even part of the hypothesis. But as I dug into the 12-team bracket, are we calling it a bracket? That feels weird, right?
Yeah, I think we can do just bracket. I think we just playoff event postseason, but bracket can work. Yeah. It is a bracket.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, Ralph, you know of what I speak. It's March, and so every football writer is going to, like, do a bracket-adjacent bracket something because of what's going on in basketball, and I hate that because it's very cliche. But the occurrence of the Field of 68 plus the comments that were going on amongst conference commissioners and media about how it should or shouldn't be, I sort of realized I had not examined the actual functionality of the 12-team format. I think we've been stuck as media on the number because there's already talk of 14. And then there's obviously we're still sort of smarting from however you want to view the Florida State omission. Mm-hmm. And no one's just sat and said, like, all right, what's the functionality of the 12-team format? And so I ran all of the data from 2014 on, all of the 4-team format years. And I became positive based on some of the likelier situations that we can get into in a second. And my positivity came from a handful of things really fast. One, I thought it's mostly compelling. Two, believe it or not, I think it does a excellent job of protecting the season, which has been sort of this traditionalist stronghold in arguments. And then three, I grew up on what is now called Group of Five football. And I think that there is a better chance for not only representation, but possibly even success relative to expectation for that Group of Five representative. So those were all positive things. I didn't expect that to happen. And yet here we are.
Yeah. And I think some of your examination, I felt like because this has been such a long process, when they first unveiled this thing in 2021, I think a lot of us sort of dived in and said, oh, look, this could be this. Look at the. But then that got washed away, like all the positivity. What I've been using a lot, Stephen, the term I've been using is, we are not getting the playoff we were promised, right? The promise of the playoff was it will lift the five Power Five conferences and maybe to a certain degree, even the G5, or keep them relevant in ways that the four-teamer was not. And then, of course, we had sweeping realignment and we lost the Power Five conference and we've gotten very focused on the money. And right, then now the number might even be changing. But you're mostly just focusing on the next 2 years when we know it's going to be 12 teams, five conference champions, seven at-large bids. And you're right. I think a lot of that got washed away. And hearing you go through it heartened me because I was either brought up a point or made me recall a point that I sort of remembered in 21 when we so fondly looked at this thing and thought this could be great for the sport, especially as you talked about, you know, this idea of what it might do to the regular season.
So everything that you just provided is, it's not negative context, but it definitely is a touch of reality in that you feel like it's a terminal illness almost because as positive as I can be, and it really, like, I guess it was sort of an exercise in, you know, we are human beings who cover the sport, and I didn't have a particularly good 2023 as a consumer of the sport. It was really hard to find a foothold or like something to get excited about. It has nothing to do with like what teams were good or bad or anything like that, but it was the trajectory of the sport overall. It's really hard to ignore what I feel like is a kind of nosedive. And so, you know, even hearing you talk about what's on the cusp, maybe 2 years from now, it's hard to stay positive. But so I guess maybe it was an intentional effort to find something to latch onto, but it is there. And I guess what I'm hoping for is that much like what happened these last 2 weeks where you had the SEC commissioner, Greg Sankey, come out and say, we got to do something about these automatic qualifiers. Because, you know, he sort of in a roundabout way painted it out that, you know, the AQ system in basketball was bad for that sport. It was bad for that event. And in college basketball, the postseason sort of is the sport, right? The viewership will certainly reflect that. We don't have that problem in football, thankfully. But he floated that idea 1 week. And then after his own conference kind of ate the curb in the opening rounds, as well as we got to see great, compelling basketball from those AQ schools specifically. And we always do. It wasn't like it was a revelation. There's always something weird that happens, and that's what we love. But we also love seeing like Oakland go on a run or Yale or any. It really doesn't matter, right? I'm hoping, and this is just hope, that we have two good years of this format, and maybe it beats back some of the greedier move towards expansion for expansion's sake, because I don't automatically feel like 14 is a better. I don't think more is better. I think 12 is a really solid number for football reasons. And I think it could really bolster the entire sport in a football sense, which would be so nice after the last couple of years that we've had.
Yeah, dive into that a little bit then. When you talk about bolstering it from a football, because part of my, I'm very much been on board with the idea of, yes, we will have less games. There will be no more games of the century. That concept in college football is now gone. But I can live with occasionally every few years missing the occasional game of the century going away. If I sit down to Georgia Tech Wake and both of those teams have a chance to make the playoff late in the season, like, that's cool. Like, I'm willing to make some of those trade-offs. So there's that. And there's also the idea that I thought I just thought the postseason in college football, like, you know, we love to listen. You and I are going to love the bowls, and we will sit in front of bowls because they will distract us from our crazy families, and we have nothing else to do at that time of the year. And I don't think you're much of a better. I'm not a better, but other people will like.
No, I'm not. I'm not at all.
Yeah, they are just betting. They are just vehicles to be bet. Also, so they have a ton of popularity. But I've always felt that the college football season, and especially in the four-teamer, kind of petered out in the postseason. So the idea of making some of these supposed big bowl games, now playoff games, makes sense to me, even if those teams are never winning national championships. I don't care about that. I don't care if Penn State and Ole Miss can't win the national championship, but I would like to see them play with all their players. So that's a good trade-off for me. Yeah. And when you were sort of looking at like the places where this can be elevated, I know you had talked about, again, that sort of like the regular season and the G5. And so, you know, feel free to dig into a little bit of like the elevation that you think is possible over the next couple of years.
Yeah. And so what Ralph was referencing there about specifically was Ole Miss and Penn State was I ran the 2023 season just as a test into this new 12 format. And one of the minor negatives initially was that you do have the inclusion of two teams in Ole Miss and Penn State who, you know, Ole Miss lost double digits decidedly to two top four teams, Georgia and Alabama. And then you had Penn State lose not so much in the margins. I'm going to say this in a nice way. They didn't lose emphatically on the scoreboard, but I think they definitely lost emphatically to both Ohio State and Michigan.
Yes.
And so there was a sort of a very, I think when that happens twice to a team, when you have 12 data points, 12 games, there's a little bit a less of an excitement as they enter into the postseason, because it's much more of like, okay, I know where you stand, right? Whereas some of these might be a wild card. You are clearly a second class citizen within your conference to those two superior programs. And I will, just to clarify, I don't not bet for any reason other than, and I don't, like, I know that's been a big thing lately for media to talk about. I just didn't do it. We had a sponsor one year on the podcast where we had to like bet a little bit and be active. Mm-hmm. And I just found it more distracting on Saturdays because I'm the kind of person who for our show is going to be as invested in like Alabama, Auburn as I am in like, you know, a Conference USA game. And so it was just honestly just too much on my plate. If we took 23 as a test dummy, first off, a lot of the concerns that we had just melt away, right? Florida State is a 5 seed. They get a home game. They're hosting Liberty. And by the way, I always want to mention this. Like, Liberty got in by a hair over SMU. So if you know if you reject Liberty on a moral stance, or you didn't watch them because they were in Conference USA, like you were really close to seeing SMU in that spot as well as a G5 team.
It was a fluky G5 year.
It really was. I think a better case study to talk about is like the Tulane team that beats USC, or the UCF Scott Frost era, or, I mean, you know, there's plenty of them. Tom Herman at Houston. We played these out on the show. We did every season. We broke it out into every season that had a selection committee as it stands now. There's a couple things that are exciting. So as a G5, you're almost always going to be that 12 seed. And if you're not paying attention right now, so there's four teams, you might be driving me with this. Four teams are going to get a bye. And it's going to be conference champions ranked 1 through 4. We can almost guarantee, Ralph, that the Big Ten and SEC champions are going to take 1 and 2 in some order. I feel confident in saying that based on the way things are going. So you're always going to have something in that 3-4 of like the ACC, Big 12, and sort of question mark. So you have a rough roadmap of where these things are going to go. Mm-hmm. What I really got excited about was the protection of conference championship weekend. Not so much because I feel like it needed protecting, but that it adds another chapter to this story of compelling, engaging entertainment. On the G5 level, you're going to have anywhere from 4 to 5 to 6 schools going down the stretch in November and into their conference championship game. And they're basically going to have to win that game, by the way, to qualify to make it as that 12 seed. You're going to have so many teams affected by that chase for that G5 rep that you're going to have compelling inventory down the stretch, like you mentioned earlier. That alone, for some of these conferences who have just been beaten down and relegated, I think that's very interesting. I had sort of just assumed they would be sent off on a death march. one of the interesting things about a five seed in this format is that based on, now this is how I did this, and this is, you can jump in and say, well, hey, the committee might have a different psychology because it's 12 teams and not four. I took data from four team years, but they still have them ranked 1 through 12 at the end, right? Mm-hmm. So the five seed is almost always the loser of the Big Ten championship or the loser of the SEC championship. Almost always. This past year was an aberration. It was Florida State, and we know why, right? Mm-hmm. The great news to me is you go into those two games in Indianapolis and Atlanta, and you have a chance to either be in the catbird seat with a 1 or a 2 seed, a home game in the next round, and a bye. But if you lose that game, like think about Alabama, Georgia in your mind right now, how close that game was this year. You fall all the way to 5 or potentially 6. You've got an extra game. And then, by the way, let's say you take care of business of the G5 rep. Let's say you just smack Liberty the way Oregon did, and you don't get a Tulane USC type situation or UCF Auburn. You still have to go on the road the next week. Yes. And what I got excited about, Ralph, and I think I mentioned this on the show, was this is where a 2022 TCU team becomes really interesting. Because then you would have a team now had to play an extra game, loses the big demoralizing conference championship before that. Now you're on the road and you're going to go to a Tallahassee. You're going to go to Fort Worth. You're going to go to one of these places. It could be Clemson, right? Where you're going to be faced with the hardest road back to national title contention. And so what that does is it puts so much importance on that first weekend in December. Mm-hmm. And essentially we have a 6-week playoff. We have narrative and meaningful games involving more teams, not just the 12, but more than that, right? The fight to get in for a month and a half. You mentioned earlier the sort of tapering off or the opt-outs, the meaningless bowl games. And it's one thing that I've really railed against these last 10 odd years of it just becomes the most tepid exhibition when half the roster opts out. And I'm not mad at the kids for doing it.
No,
because
not at
by
all.
The way, most of those bowl games you watch, it is a skeleton crew of a coaching staff.
That's right? Exactly.
Somebody's
it.
Left. Right. Somebody's leaving. Somebody's an interim. Somebody got fired. You know, it's a bit of a joke. We've seen multiple times, like, I think it was maybe the Pinstripe Bowl or the Fenway Bowl this year where it was like two sets of interims and guys are just, you know, you're talking about phoning it in. This is going to eliminate more of that, and it's going to create more compelling inventory. So at the outset, before I can get into more like specific hypothetical matchups, you're raising the bar for inventory. The last thing I don't want to push back on is you're not going to have a game of the century insofar as if Michigan beats Ohio State or Ohio State beats Michigan Thanksgiving weekend, one of those teams is not moving on. That is probably not going away, or at least in the years where they're both like undefeated, like, you know, and they're both ranked in the top five.
Agree with that. Yes.
You're not going to have that more, almost certainly. However, the trade-off for that is, to me, so disproportionately bountiful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you're losing meaning in that game whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even think that's possible, even if the teams do meet up again. I know that that's a personal preference, and I don't really have like empirical data, but that's kind of and maybe you differ. That's like the loudest argument I've sort of received so far about expansion of the playoff from traditionalists. I just don't find that situation to be that likely. Also, I think the Big Ten and I'm not endorsing expansion. I think it's kind of ruining the sport, but by bringing in more quality football programs is probably or almost certainly lowering the odds of like a Michigan Ohio State Big Ten championship rematch the following week.
So I think that's true. I also think we might be overrating a little bit, and this goes back to a conversation we keep having, and I think you guys will have it on the show as well with Richard Johnson and Alex Kirshner. Those are Stephen's partners on the Split Zone Duo. If you don't listen to it, you should. This idea that we're heading into a new world order where suddenly 2-3 lost teams are good teams, right? Like the idea that it's going to be 11-1 Michigan against 12-0 Ohio State at the end of the season continually is that's going to be out the way. I mean, there will be some years when those teams, because those, especially Ohio State, is going to be good enough to get through. But I think we are probably very much underestimating how often we're going to get to the end of the season, even with the very good teams having one or two losses, which also sets up this idea that don't assume that the loser of a conference championship game is definitely getting in. Again, in this new world where you're going to be entering that game with two losses, and I think that's going to become, even in the SEC and Big Ten, more frequent, you may be playing for your spot in that game, and the loser might be out.
I can say with some certainty that will definitely be the case as you go down the line.
Yeah.
ACC.
I'm not saying every year, but I'm just saying don't just assume both conference championship representatives are going to get in. I think that would be a bad assumption.
Yes. I think that I hope you're right. I hope that there's more dynamic stakes year to year. And I hope that there isn't as much assumed certainty when you hit a certain point. I want to believe this isn't just going to be sort of a log jam of Big Ten and SEC teams getting that third shot, that fourth shot. Like, I want it to be.
I mean, it's going to be a lot of that, Stephen. But
I know.
That's okay. I do think it's not going to be just that. And as you said, as the start of this, when to go back to the hope and optimism part of this, there are a lot of stakes baked in. Like, the bye is important. The home game is important. And if you don't get those things, that drastically changes your road. So it will make those other games leading down the stretch of the season important. That's the whole point.
Well, I can make Florida State fans mad again. Not that I want to, but, you know.
Please don't.
I ran that 12-team
format. So mad all the time.
They are, yes. They are an angry people. I ran that 12-team simulation based off of the selection committee that we got for the 4-team format. Obviously, Florida State's the 5. Were they the 4 in that scenario? And here's where I get into, and I kind of tested this with my co-host, because it's not conspiratorial. I just do think that psychology plays a role in this. If the committee was seeding 12 and they knew they were seeding 12, maybe they do put the ACC champion Florida State team as the 4 and then that Bama team as the 5, maybe.
Oh, yeah. I'm with you. I think everything changes. I've always thrown out the caveat that we're going to use the previous rankings that we're going to 4. But understand, it's a very different mindset when 5 doesn't matter, when who is 5 and who is 6 doesn't matter. When the only thing that matters is 4 or 5, it's a different, you're ranking things differently. And they can say they're not, but they are, because it just is.
The beauty of that, if we're, let's walk with that assumption for a second, and let's say that the committee no longer is the stress is not on the 4-5 line, it's way down the ranks. Mm-hmm. And they just give the ceremonial push to the ACC team that went undefeated and won the conference championship. Well, that's great. But the reality, the benefit of that for Florida State is they get a bye, mm-hmm. because they have an injury situation at quarterback, right?
Mm-hmm.
So imagine the fortunes of a Florida State team who gets to wait a week and host a home game.
Right.
In that specific situation. That's where, again, the buys from the assistants that I've talked to, and they haven't really thought, I mean, no one in the coaching ranks I've talked to has really paid much mind to this yet.
Yeah.
I think as they get into offseason, it's coming.
Yeah, they don't think about it until it's there. Not until it's there, as in they're in the playoff. But they'll start thinking about it this year. They'll start thinking about this offseason, like this summer.
Right, and when they do, I'm going to be really curious what the sort of game theory is on managing roster health and all that, because you're going to come off of that extra 13th game in the conference championship against a sort of, you know, national title caliber opponent. And then you get the extra week. Well, I've talked to fans and media who feel like, hey, we're going to see the layoff effect, which is something we talk a lot about in other sports.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that comes up in baseball a lot, because I think baseball's playoff has been incredibly random. And they're actually trying to maybe, you know, I think they might try and work on that a little bit, where favored teams are the wild card is feeding into sort of momentum. I don't know if that carries over to the sport of football the same way, although we have seen in the NFL runs before by like the six seed wild card.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I'm going to pause here. This is what's exciting. This is what is actually sort of positive after 2 and 3 and 5 and 6 and 10 years of realignment and network grant of rights conversations, is that we're sitting here kind of doing the thing that made us all fans, most of us fans in the first place, which is like, you get your magazines open and you're getting your preseason guides and you're sitting there and you're playing with brackets and you're just like, you know, this is fun. This is exciting. And I don't even need to arrive at a point where I say, hey, this is perfect or this is not, or they shouldn't make this and these guys shouldn't have buys. The fact that we're sitting in this conversation right now is such a palate cleanser compared to where we've been the last couple of years.
Okay, I'm going to tilt this conversation as we wind down with you a little bit more toward the not so optimistic and hopeful. And you're right. I think that we just talked about the fun of putting together the bracket, seeing what the combinations might be and the matchups might be. And the fact of the matter is that's fun. And thinking about how the season might play out in this context is fun.
It's not Clemson's in court. It's not hearing about like or having had to have a debate about editorial bias in the SEC network. Like, I'll beat those drums because I believe in those things. But I, as someone who sort of like, I kind of made a name in the industry for like being in the muck, like the gossip world and Bagman and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm not saying that we shouldn't spend time there because I think that you really draw. You drill into a raw honesty, but I just felt like the last couple of years we've looked around and that's all, it's all levels and shades of that. And yeah. I just like, I know if I hit a point where I'm like, can we please talk about ball? That most of the people out there are probably disenfranchised too.
Yeah. We needed a shower. So let me hit you with this. Cause you are the G5 guy and I got a couple
we
more minutes
priest.
Of your time.
Yeah.
Yeah. An exorcist.
Yeah.
We are moving into a new generation of G5-ness. There is even a question of whether we can have another use. And again, this is kind of brings us back to the business side and maybe brings us down a little bit, but we're going to try not to do that too much here. So I understand that there is a question of whether we will ever have another, the system is set up to have a G5 team rise up, move on and become a flowering superstar like UCF, one of your favorite schools. Among the new G5 and the new layout of the G5, what I asked you before you came on was,
yeah,
are there a couple of schools that can become the next, right? Because we're kind of looking at, you know, that's how we ended up with Liberty last year. We kind of looked around like, none of these teams are that great. Like, I wonder who the next G5 powerhouse might be. And if I threw that to you, you got a couple that you think could maybe break through?
Oof.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And again, I hate to end the show on a downer, but like that's my point. Yes.
I would like to be hopeful that they're coming. But when I saw that note, I'm kind of stalling for time here. I think we're split. Okay. Everything for the past like playoff era on was always the Power Five and then the Power Five and then. So there was one fulcrum. Okay. And so we lived on that. Houston, Cincinnati, UCF, Boise.
Mm-hmm.
I think we might be seeing the split in. We're going to see multiple fractures. I don't know how to process that yet. I'm going to be honest.
And then I see what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, like in two to four years, I'm curious how we're viewing. Those big two and other twos, the more rank and file schools, like, are we going to feel about like a Iowa State gets on a hot run in the Big 12? Are we going to treat them like we treated the Houston of 10 years ago?
That's a good point. That's a good point, Stephen.
Because right now, I don't see what we have called G5 instantly producing another. Although I will say that, like, I don't like the way the committee's treated them ever. I do feel like it's getting even more myopic. And I do, I, I'll, if I really wanted to be partisan, I think the Sun Belt may be beating itself up a little bit too much.
Mm.
And I think the committee's dumb in the way that they look at G5, and that if the idea of like Liberty cruising to an undefeated record in an obviously inferior conference,
mm-hmm.
compared to like a high performing American or Sun Belt team with one or two losses, I think that's just bad committeeing. Mm-hmm. So like Troy's going to give you like that John Summerall Troy program was like, it was going to give you a headache. It was going to they played an incredibly physical brand of football, especially for the size and athleticism disparity to a Power Five team. Like, that was a well-coached, well-executing football team. And so they're out there and the future's there. If I wanted to end on the down note, what's disenfranchising is to watch like Mo Lindquist leave Buffalo to be a co-DC with Kane Womack, who mm-hmm. left mm-hmm. USA, South Al, to be a co-DC. Like, that part breaks me a little bit. Because I don't know if we're going to stick around and see runs like that. And look, you know why Liberty's so good right now? Maybe the best they've ever been is because Jamie Chadwell was considered to be like, for some reason, this like misfit toy who couldn't get a proper P5 job. And so he took the highest paying G5 job he could.
Yeah.
That's why Liberty is relevant, is they're dumping a stupid amount of money relative to their place into their football program.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that makes them the next UCF. I would argue against it. But
right now it would be very hard to make that claim.
Yeah. Yeah. But your point, I thought is excellent. The idea that I am probably looking through the wrong lens here, right? The lens is no longer the chasm between G5 and Power 5. We are heading for a three-tiered system. So what does look like?
It feels that way. Yeah. And then if it does, and I'm right, what's the point of including that bottom tier? That's what a lot of people are going to start saying.
Okay. All right. We're getting negative again. I brought you on for optimism sunny optimism and positivity, because that is your brand. Stephen Godfrey, right. You can find him at the Split Zone Duo podcast with Richard Johnson and Alex Kirshner. You can read him places. I don't want to assume that your deal that last year is going to be your deal this year. So I don't want to say anything, but I can read you at places.
Oh yeah. 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 I'll be back at the Post this fall. Yeah. Okay, I have a weekly column in the Washington Post basically from it's like August until February.
Gotcha. And guys do like Substack now? No.
So all the splits I do exist on Substack. Yes. So there is newsletter content, video content, podcast content. We have, you can subscribe for free on a podcast service. And then sort of, we also have a subscription package with a bunch of other stuff. So yeah.
Yeah. It's very good stuff. Go find it. Stephen, thank you very much for doing this. Always appreciate your time and hope to run into you sooner rather than later.
Thank you, Ralph.
And now 3 and Out. First down. Let's talk expansion, but not of the playoff, but the NCAA basketball tournament. It's been a hot topic, with SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey being cast as something of a villain for suggesting the basketball committee needs to maybe rethink what it does with automatic qualifying bids from smaller, lower resource conferences. Then, of course, the SEC laid a huge egg, getting only two of its eight teams through to the Sweet 16, with Yale and Oakland knocking off Auburn and Kentucky, respectively. And we all had a good laugh at that on Twitter this past weekend. My quick thoughts on expansion. I think I'm in the same camp as Val Ackerman, the Big East commissioner. I would prefer leaving it alone, but a modest expansion, 4 to 8 teams, makes sense in the context of a larger Division I. Simple math. There are more Division I schools, so maybe a few more teams should make the tournament. The NCAA Transformation Committee recommended championship fields should be 25% of schools that participate in a sport. I'm not advocating for that, but I can see the reasoning behind it, and it could be done by growing what is now called the first four to a first six or a first eight, have another Dayton-type site, maybe two around the country. What I do not want to see, what I think almost no one wants to see, is the auto bid leagues get marginalized or pushed out of the tournament. There are 32 conferences. All of them should have representation in the tournament. And I don't want them relegated to just the play-in games. The first four now has two games matching 16 seeds that are auto bid schools, and two games matching at-large teams that come from the multi-bid leagues. This season, it was Virginia, Colorado State, Boise State versus Colorado. My fear, and the fear of many in low mid majors, is an expanded first four will be nothing but auto bid champions, which means fewer opportunities for those teams to play the highly seeded teams. Listen, I understand that most of those games are lopsided. I covered UConn Stetson. Trust me, I saw the worst of it. Only two 16 seeds have ever won a tournament game against a number one, but it's relevant that after years of it not happening, it happened twice in the span of 6 years to Virginia and Purdue. Unlike college football, the margins in college basketball are narrowing everywhere seemingly but UConn. This is not the time to give those schools, those automatic bid, one bid league schools, fewer opportunities to knock off the big boys. Leave the auto bids alone and don't cordon off all the low mid majors from the rest of the tournament. Another issue is more and more conferences are becoming one big conferences. The Missouri Valley and the A-10 in particular are getting fewer bids. But that's a slightly different discussion about how the teams are picked after the tournament is expanded. Expansion is almost certainly going to result in more bids for the SEC, Big Ten, ACC, Big 12, throw in the Big East while you're at it. I would like to see some thought given to the fact that the mid-majors are basically getting squeezed because the big conferences are playing among themselves, giving the mid-majors fewer and fewer opportunities to prove themselves in the regular season. I'm not advocating for a bunch of America East and MEAC teams getting in, but as you go deeper into these power leagues, the question is not so much can Indiana State or Appalachian State compete against the best of the Big 12 or SEC. It's how would they compare to the 10th best in those leagues, teams that have already been given plenty of opportunity to play their way into the tournament. If you've been given 18 to 20 games in the conference to show your worth against tournament level competition, and the best you could do with it was less than break even, you have not earned more opportunities. Not in a world where, again, the margins have become pretty thin, where nobody can win on the road, and where it has been proven time and time again that an older, less talented team has a pretty damn good chance against a younger, less experienced, but more talented team. The selection process ultimately is subjective. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way, but that's a topic for another time. Last word on expansion is, as always, this is as much about money as it is about competition. The TV networks are not obligated to provide more money for more games. The deal is locked through 2034. What will probably happen is the smaller conferences will guard their access to the tournament by giving the bigger conferences more of the money via performance units that maybe grow as teams advance deeper into the tournament and or upfront guarantees that are bigger for the SEC and the Big Ten than they are for, say, the Patriot League and the Southland. I helped my colleague Will Graves with a story that published recently on expansion, and I'll link to it in the show notes. Second down, let's talk Deion Sanders. Coach Prime last week came out and said, "I'm not recruiting the way other coaches do." The problem is, if you peel back the onion, what he's actually saying is, "I'm not recruiting." And the results back that up. So it has become very apparent to me that this is not going to work at CU. You cannot build a winning program without recruiting high school players better than Sanders is recruiting high school players now. Period. End of story. I'm not being a hater. In fact, I'll even cop to being hopeful that Sanders would turn around Colorado for two reasons. A, he is such a compelling and charismatic personality. Good, bad, or indifferent, having him around the sport is incredibly interesting. Having someone try something different is interesting. Bringing a program that has been down for a while back to relevance is cool. It's especially cool for me personally because the last great CU teams coincide with me really falling head over heels for college football. There is sentimentality at play here for me as well. But the last truly hopeful moment for CU football came against Nebraska in week two. Everything that has happened since has chipped away reasons to be optimistic about the long-term forecast for the Buffs under Coach Prime. It's certainly possible CU is better this season than it was last season when it won four games, though if you look at the schedule, good luck finding six wins. We've talked a lot about how the Big 12 is going to lack heavyweights and high-ceiling programs, but it's still going to be a pretty darn good conference. There will likely be about 8 to 10 top 40-ish programs in that league. CU is not contending for a title with a team built almost entirely from the portal. Even if there was enough good players in the portal to build a conference contender, the fact is Colorado isn't even landing the best players in the portal. Listen, I will never criticize Colorado for hiring Sanders. The program has been down for so long that I think bringing in Coach Prime to give it a boost and make it relevant was a reasonable, calculated risk. The team got marginally better last year, and CU certainly got its money's worth in attention and ticket sales. But that stuff doesn't last without winning. And as interesting as Sanders is, and as much as it would be a really cool story for him to break college football and find success in an unorthodox way, there is no evidence to support that's going to happen. So the next part of the story, which also promises to be pretty fascinating, frankly, is how does this all play out without the success on the field? Third down, Clemson was next up to sue the ACC as it tries to extricate itself from the conference. I don't think it'll be any easier for Clemson than it is for Florida State, though I will say Clemson's arguments in their lawsuit are a little more succinct as opposed to FSU, which took sort of a kitchen sink approach to arguing the grant of rights doesn't mean what the ACC says it means. I think the college football playoff situation with uneven revenue and the mere talk of the Big Ten and SEC being given greater access through extra auto bids and guaranteed buys was the final straw for Clemson. I'll say the same thing about Clemson as I did about FSU. I think the marriage between the school and the ACC is probably beyond repair. My guess is if they were both willing to write a giant check or to write giant checks, the ACC would be open to accepting them. I'm not sure what's on the other side for Clemson here, just like I'm not really sure what's on the other side for Florida State. No doubt something. But exactly what that is hard to spot from here because there's so much about college sports that is unsettled right now. Also, I'm really not sure why Clemson felt compelled to not just wait and see how things played out with FSU, other than, well, they probably have a growing segment of the fan base and booster class that is saying you just need to do something. That's the show for today. Thanks to my producer, John Radcliffe, for making me sound good. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you like to get your pods. Please follow so you do not miss an episode. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for listening, and come back for more next week of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast.